What's new?
Is this the start of the show? I never know.
All right, let's start. In three...
That was a good start.
No, it wasn't.
You sound out of breath.
It's either us starting with, coming up today on the show, blah, 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 or it's... Is this the start of the show?
That's it. Those are the two. That one of them is when you start, and the other is when I start.
Just once, I would love for you to say, "Hey, what's new with you?" Mm-hmm. And then that would start. But
I never know when you're ready.
But there's always just dead silence, so mm-hmm. I feel compelled to kick it off.
Right? There's like heavy breathing mm-hmm. on the other side. Sometimes like you're eating soup or blowing your nose,
right?
Or practicing saxophone. And I just kind of wait, and I think sooner or later he'll acknowledge that he accepted the call, right? So, without further ado, what's new with you?
Well, you know, so we were out in San Francisco, and I was on those antibiotics, right, in an effort to try to get healthy. And I thought, you know, antibiotics, like, that kills anything, right?
Right. Well, it did say on the prescription bottle, consume only on the West Coast. So I see how these two things are connected.
Well, that must have been the problem, right? Because antibiotics kill anything. And I guess just on the West Coast, it'll kill, you know, it'll kill gonorrhea.
Oh.
Right? It'll kill any host of... you know, any host of diseases, right? Mm-hmm. Normally kills any sort of virus you get. Rhinovirus, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of the nose.
Uh-huh.
And so I started feeling better. Then we hit the flight to come back, and boom, all over again. Just sick again from the stinking airplane. So then I saw the doctor today. He said, all right, I'm going to double the antibiotic dose, which I didn't know you could do. Did you know this?
Sure. You just take twice as much, Clayton. That's how.
Right, but I mean...
That's the mathematics behind it.
Why wouldn't you just do that to begin with, right? So he's like, all right, we're going to double it. So now he said, do you have enough left? And I said, well, no, because I finished the whole first... So now I need to like double up. Instead of 250 milligrams, I have to do 500 milligrams a day of some antibiotic to try to get through this thing.
You know, I'm no fractions whiz, but I think 500 milligrams could be reduced to a simpler unit.
Could it? Like what? Two pills? I could have just said two pills. All right,
right,
so two pills, yeah.
Well, I meant, generally speaking, right, milligram must be of 1,000, right? So 500. There must be a simpler unit of measure. That's what I'm getting at. But I like how you did it. You went right to the two pills.
Yeah.
So, hey, I don't know if you saw this in our mailbox, but a friend of ours and also fellow podcaster, Doug Connolly, wrote to us. In the Grizzly Bear Cafe mailbox.
This,
That's grizzlybearcafe@gmail.com. He wrote to Clayton and I first. He recommended the first Black Keys album to Clayton.
Yeah, what's the name of that album? Because I had mentioned the Black Keys album Brothers last week on the show.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. I felt guilty even reading that part because he addressed it to you.
So it was like you reading my mail.
Kind of.
Right.
You know. Like usually I have to park outside your house to do that.
Right.
This was a lot more convenient.
When you rifle through my love letters.
Mm-hmm. Of which Clayton does receive copious amounts. Then he wrote two things to me. One, he corrected a story that I told here on the Grizz a few weeks ago about a field trip that I recalled taking place in third grade. In fact, it was fourth grade, says Doug. Because
thank God we got that right.
Right. It dislodged in his mind the memory of class loudmouth John Hoffa being dressed down by an Abraham Lincoln impersonator. That's the notable part of that story. Then he also asked, I don't know, but at some past point on a Grizz, we must have alluded to, but not told in its entirety, a story that involved a horrific tobogganing accident.
Oh, yeah, your tobogganing accident.
Now, this part of it's not clear to me. Were you there when this happened? Like, were you on the Wilson Hill when this occurred?
I don't recall being there, mm-hmm. but then again, my memory has faded. Like, I think senility is already setting in for me.
Mm.
Maybe it's my continual lack of sleep, mm-hmm. but I don't recall being there. I'm certain I would have remembered you zipping over or down a hillside, then up a ramp of snow, mm-hmm. midair in your dad's classic toboggan from like the 1940s.
Mm-hmm.
Right, like he got it, like he got it in Normandy, France, or something like that. It's like that classic, right?
Yeah, it was the product of his first apprenticeship.
Right, he whittled it out of a tree when he was working with a group of Native Americans
with a spoon and a herring.
And then he celebrated by having a dinner of maize. So I don't recall that, but I do. And then you zipped up the side of this hill, and this snow bank over the top of this tennis court fence because the snow was so high. And I don't know what you thought, but then it was like a 30-foot drop, and you then smashed down onto the tennis court, and it shattered into 1,000 pieces.
Yeah.
And somewhere, a Native American shed a tear.
He did. He did.
Just like that 70s campaign commercial.
He said, "I will sled no more forever." Clayton encapsulated fairly well there, Doug. I remember the other riders on the toboggan most likely included, they definitely included Todd Dushinsky, who had to drive me home after the accident. John Nevitt, Jeff Smith, and Evan Bruck are the most likely other candidates to have been riding on this giant toboggan, which, as Clayton said, did belong to my father, and which we destroyed. The Wilson Hill, that is to say the hill adjacent to the school we all went to, Wilson, was a hot spot for wintertime sledding, was it not? Like, in our area of places that could be reached within walking distance, Wilson Right. Hill was, that was the place to go.
Right. There are very few other hills that were appropriate, that had like a long enough slope where there weren't obtrusions in the way. So for many of you, and it's surprising, when I was out in California with my wife when we were in San Francisco, I said, you know, does it ever snow here? And she's like, of course not. You know, it snows like maybe once every 8 years. And even then it's like a dusting and it lasts for like 4 minutes.
Right.
And I thought, how tragic, you know? And there are parts of this country, right? They never see snow. They don't understand how it works, how it functions. Well, you need a hill that has no obtrusions, right? Mm-hmm. Or obstructions, I guess.
Obstructions, right.
You know, like a tree trunk or a giant rock or, you know, a dead turtle or something like that. You don't want any of those things in your way as you're racing
landmines.
Down the hill. Yeah, so, you know, so Kosovo wouldn't work.
That's bad sledding territory. Right? It's sad to me, the idea that there are places, and obviously there are, right? I mean, at least what I understand about temperatures and the equator and that sort of junk, that there are children who will never grow up, or will grow up without the pleasure of a snow day.
Right, but they'll grow up with the delicious taste of jerk chicken.
That's the trade-off.
Right.
It's either jerk chicken or... So, on this fateful day... somehow we liberated the toboggan from its slumbering place in the rafters above my dad's car in the garage, and we absconded with it via the Subaru station wagon in the possession of one Todd Dushinsky to the Wilson Hill, where a number of other sledding kids that may have included Clayton, maybe not, it definitely included Jay Zapata. I remember him being there, as he was, jointly, between Clayton and I, one of our least favorite people in the universe. So
that's accurate, yeah.
Right. Hopefully he's one of the 2 million eggheads. So, sorry, Jay. Sorry for that revelation there. Anyway, at the bottom of the hill, there were the tennis courts where the school's tennis team would play, and there was a dumpster. This was kind of the key to it. There was a dumpster up against the fence, and I would say the dumpster was maybe 4 or 5 feet high, and the fence was another 4 or 5 feet higher than that. And throughout the course of the day, as we'd had a healthy snowfall, the kids were building a rampway up the side of the dumpster of snow, and then continuing it with the thought process that someone might be able to jump over the fence into the tennis court. But as Clayton said, the thought process really didn't extend any further than that. And whether it was because we just had so many riders that the sled weighed enough, like I'm not claiming to understand the science behind it, but after several hours of trial and error, eventually I, along with 3 or 4 riders on the toboggan, managed to jump into the tennis court. And of course, as Clayton said, we didn't plan any further than that. So the toboggan crashed down and just like exploded. It just detonated into a million pieces. And like, I think maybe we tipped over in midair or something like that. You know, like we went bottoms up. And I remember, you know, like at some point, I think I was knocked out for a couple seconds. And I woke up. And it looked like a war had happened in those 5 seconds, you know, or whatever, however long I was out. And that, like, you know, my friends were, like, scattered around, like, homicide chalk drawings or, like, just a pair of legs sticking out of snow, kicking upside down. Like, where's the top half of John Nevitt?
It was very Bugs Bunny-ish.
Right. It really did. It had, and there was just, like, wooden chips and chunks everywhere. And I had, because if you can believe this, at the time, it was popular to wear stonewashed jeans. I had these, like, they were so stonewashed, they were almost white, basically. They weren't even the pale blue anymore. these jeans that I had on, just like by the force of it or whatever, were just like destroyed. Like there was like some little chunks of denim hanging by threads, but the force of the, you know, the landing on whatever made the toboggan explode, or
are you
know,
Bruce
the shrapnel.
Bruce Banner?
I don't know. I don't know. But that's what it was like. It was like I'd had a Hulk out and turned back into Banner. But like my shirt and my jacket and everything else was all right, but just my pants were destroyed. And it was just like me in my underwear out on the Wilson Hill while it was snowing. And
yeah.
So I had to wake Todd up, and I said, "You got to take me home. I got to get some more pants." And we did. We went home, got pants, and came back and, you know, just sledded with other things, you know, like on one of those plastic ones that you get from, you know, Ronco's pharmacy or whatever. But I couldn't explain it to you any more than that. Like I said, it was just sort of like I was revived, and you know, I was like, oh, I must have had a Hulk out or something there. Well, that happened. And
what are the best sleds to use? You know, because I think sleds have evolved, right? Last year, my son, you know, my young son, I'm familiar with him. Yeah, you've met him a time or two. He's tiny, and he can't, you know, navigate a sled. You know, he was under a year old when.
But to be fair, you haven't really given him a chance, have you?
No, I mean, we put him at the top of that hill. We strapped him into a sled, and we pushed him. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't make it very far until he hit a tree. But mm-hmm. Other than that, no, we had this little hill in my front yard, and he would sit on my lap, and we'd go down the sled. So we went to, I think it was Walmart or something, and we bought some sleds. Mm-hmm. And my, how they have evolved, right? They're like the super racer sleds. Back when we were growing up, they were just like, it was like a dinner tin or something like that, right? Or
yes,
like a piece of Tupperware. I mean, it was not extravagant.
Like one of those disposable baking tins
right.
with a rope on it.
Right. I mean, it was not extravagant at all. Now it's got like grooves built into the bottom of it for extra speed. You know, mm-hmm. it's got wings on it, you know, mm-hmm. and for super absorbency.
A low jack.
Right. It's got OnStar. So when mm-hmm. you crash into a tree, it notifies the people that you've been in an accident.
You've been in a crash.
But then, you know, I think, you know, because like the Griswolds, right, in National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, right, mm-hmm. they have that famous one where...
Right. It's like the Captain America shield turned upside down.
Right, like super greased on the bottom. Now, do those work? Because I always feel like when I get in those, if the snow is too soft, you bury like the front of it in it, and you just sort of go toppling over.
Yeah, I never had one of those, but certainly I had friends that did, and I thought its effectiveness was questionable at best. I do remember another sledding story that you may recall. It took place 10 or 11 years ago when I came to visit you in this great state of Montana.
Oh, I remember this, yeah.
When one day we...
Well, see, this is part of the evolution of the sled, right? Because then suddenly everyone started using, like, the inflatables.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So, yeah, we went to, I don't know what it was,
Walmart or something.
Yeah, because God knows they're everywhere. So we decided we were going to go sled on a hill that had not been, I don't even think like anyone had ever navigated this hill, right?
It was amazing. It was like the whole side of a mountain of virgin snow. There wasn't a footstep. There wasn't like a bird's footprint. There was nothing.
Probably for good reason, because it was perilous.
It was
sheer. Right.
Yeah.
It was,
yeah.
And you could tell, like, no one had ever probably laid eyes on this hill, had mm-hmm. ever, you know, like Lewis and Clark wouldn't show up on their maps. Like, it was treacherous, right? Mm-hmm.
But it did bottom out at like the one major artery in and out of Helena.
Right, which was great. So if we actually, this is how asinine we are, right? Like, if we had been successful in sledding down that hill, we would have wound up on like I-78,
right,
or whatever it was,
yeah,
in the middle of it, with like tractor trailers coming by.
But again, not unlike the dumpster jump, we really didn't think that far. You know, the main difference, of course, is like that story I just told you about my pants being obliterated takes place in 1991, whereas this story takes place in 2000.
Right,
like we were a bit older.
Right, we were adults,
but,
by all accounts.
But I think what it was, you know, when I came to visit you out there, I think there were certain elements of that experience that had a charm to them. And the idea that there was like a whole side of a mountain that no one had yet sled on, despite the fact, you know, at this point we were out of college and everything else. I think it just seemed like someone must sled this hill, Clayton.
Yeah.
And I think we tried a few different places before we found the sled. Like, we went a couple places, and they're like, we don't have any sleds here. And, oh, who sleds in Montana? And we're like, are you crazy?
We just shoot moose. What are you talking about?
So, finally, when we did it, it just seemed like it had to be done. Like, we were going to get on this inflatable inner tube, and we were gonna take this mountain by storm. And correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think, like, maybe on the second run, we punctured it.
Right. We literally owned it for 5 minutes before we punctured it. And we were riding it in tandem, right? It was just somehow we both sat on it. And it was very gay of us, right? Like, we were... Like, I sat, then you, like, wrapped your legs around me.
I'd lay down, Clayton would lay on top of me, and we would just kind of lazily drift down the side of the mountain in this 9-foot snow.
It was like the Saturday Night Live. It was like the ambiguously gay duo. Like, the way we had to position ourselves on this sled to get down the hill.
Oh, like, but we were going to do it. We were going to get to the bottom and, you know, whatever, race out onto the major highway.
Right. And the brilliance of it was when we sat on this inflatable tube... which I think one of us hyperventilated from having to inflate.
Mm-hmm.
Once we finally sat on
Okay, also to be understood, right? We went on top of a mountain, and it's freezing cold, right? So the air is as thin as can possibly be, and we're up there like trying to blow up this inflatable inner tube for two. So that might have been a mistake. Maybe we should have done that in the car while the heat was on.
One of our genius ideas. But we didn't, because, you know, you can't tell what's under... Here's the problem, right? You can't tell. You know, like they say, weathermen always say this, right? Don't ever drive through, like if it's raining or whatever, and you can't see the road, and then certainly there's like standing water on the road. You don't know how deep that water is, so don't drive through it, right? Like, it could be over top of a giant pothole that if you go into, your car is going to go submerged.
Yes.
The same is true of snow on a hill, really, because you don't know what's underneath it, right? It's laying on top of any number of objects.
Yeah.
And that was the case with this hill.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There was snowpack, and in Montana, it starts snowing in September. It doesn't stop until September. Mm-hmm. And so you have all of this snowpack, and then, you know, you've got logs and boulders and such. So you and I made, like, one little path down, because you need to, like, clear a path first, right? You need to make, like, a trough, you know?
Yeah.
So that worked. We went, like, I don't know, maybe 100 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And then, do you recall, then I think the next time...
I think part of it was we probably thought, well, we need more of a running start.
Right.
And then we both leapt in the ambiguously gay duo way. We leapt onto it at the same time. And I think between that and everything else, we somehow punctured this inflatable inner tube thing.
Clearly on a rock or a stick jutting out as we went down.
But I really did feel defeated, you know, because like you said, we'd really only owned it for about 5 minutes.
Right, and we spent all afternoon trying to find this thing.
Our whole day was consumed with finding this thing. And they were so quickly defeated. So we had a lot of great times there in Helena, Montana. but one of them, on the flip side of this somewhat defeatist story, right, that I do want to tell, was about a restaurant that I recall being titled the Frontier Pie Company. Do you remember this as well?
Yeah, I think it was the Frontier Pie Company. You're right about that. And wasn't it going out of business? Or maybe it wasn't until you went back there that you discovered it was out of business.
Right, I did discover that it went out of business because I visited where it had previously been located. I actually went into the – it became a bar restaurant, and I went in and asked them. And I said – you know, I basically said, I haven't been here in years, but I kind of remember this used to be the Frontier Pie Company. And they said, yes, it was up until maybe 2004, but, you know, it went out of business. Anyway – this place, as you can imagine, based on that name, their specialty was pies.
Delicious.
But it was also a full-service diner. It wasn't like you just went in there for pie. And I remember a couple nights. Like, the night that I got into Helena, not by flying into Helena, I was rerouted to wherever the heck I went, and you had to come and fetch me.
Yeah, an hour south in Butte because of the terrible weather.
Mm-hmm. So, right, that was a great idea, flying in there in November. Right. So Clayton came to get me in Butte. And we drove back. It was a really scenic drive back, too. You know, it was snowing and, you know, the mountains and everything else. It was a beautiful drive. And we got there, and I said, let's go get something to eat. Like, I'd been in airports all day, delayed, you know, rerouted and everything else. And there really wasn't, like, the 24-hour diner phenomenon in Helena, Montana that we were used to back home in Redding. It wasn't like you had Denny's and Dempsey's and all these other options. And the West Redding Diner,
right,
maker of great French fries. And there was just that one... place that we ended up going to. And then later on in the week, we discovered this other place that was open late, but not 24 hours, called the Frontier Pie Company, where right when you came in, they had a giant display case that had all the pies that they'd made. And there was like a signboard up on the wall where they listed what all the pies were that were going to be available for that day. Do you remember this?
I do. Yeah, they had like 10 specialty pies, like on the, you know, that was hand-scrawled in chalk or something like that.
Right. So we were closing it down the night that you and I were in there. And, you know, I'm not, forgive this if it seemed overly stereotypical, but at least all the people I've met during my time in Montana were like overly friendly. They were very, very friendly, very, very sociable people. And now back home, to contrast this, if we were like at Dempsey's before they went out of business, if you were at Dempsey's and they were closing it down and they had a bunch of pies in the case, and you happened to go up as you were paying your bill and noticed the pies, at no point would someone working at Dempsey's offer you the pies, because those pies are about to be thrown out, right? They're going to close and throw them away. That would never happen in our hometown, never in a million years.
Right.
But to contrast that, in Helena, Montana, as we were closing it down and we were leaving, we were up at the counter paying, they said to us, you know, we're just going to throw these pies away, right? Do you want them?
Right.
And the answer, if anyone ever offers you free pie, is yes.
Right. Just like if someone ever asks you if you're a god, you say yes.
That's right.
And what pies did we get?
Well, we took at least three or four fairly intact, you know, maybe a slice or two missing pies with us home.
And I think, yeah, back to my rented Victorian house that I was renting for an obscene amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
Now, bear in mind, like, you know, I was paying more in rent than I was making at the time.
He was also paying more in heating bills than he was paying in rent than he was making at the time.
It's brutal. Like $500 a month. But anyway, we took these pies back. I think we subsisted on these pies for like a week, right? Like it was lunch for us.
But we were, I mean, I don't know why, you know, what that is about certain places like that. Like they wouldn't just give you the food, you know, if it was just going to waste. Like, I know that was McDonald's policy when we worked there, right? Like, if the food was coming up on its expiration time, you could not eat it or you couldn't give it away. You had to throw it away.
Right.
You know, and I guess now, when you think about McDonald's, right, there's more of a corporate culture at work there, right? Somebody somewhere probably got sick from being given a free, like, hamburger that was about to be disposed of, sued the company, and there's a real reason for that. But, like, a mom and, like, Dempsey's, you know, when Dempsey's was in business, there was, like, two of them. You know, I don't think that they had gone through the same, you know, they hadn't poisoned somebody or whatever. So, I don't understand, you know, the rationale behind that. Or, like, shouldn't they, I don't mean this in, like, a preachy way, I'm just throwing this out there as a potential hypothesis. Restaurants like that, shouldn't you have something kind of deal worked out with like your local homeless shelter or something?
Right. Well, where, I think some of them do, right? Well, I'm always reminded of that Seinfeld episode where like the muffin store.
I knew you were going to talk about the muffin store.
Where like Elaine drops off the stumps the of the muffin. And I love that the woman's name is Rebecca De Mornay, who runs the homeless shelter, and she drops them off. She's like, and she freaks out at it, this big black woman. She says, who do you think we are? She's like, where are the tops of the muffins? We want the tops of the muffins. What do you think we are, just eating your stumps? You just think some homeless people, they'll just eat whatever they want. We're just going to eat your stumps of your muffins. I just recall that. But I think they do. Don't they, like, give, you know, some, you know, maybe day-old bagels away? Or is that not...
I hope.
Is that insulting?
I don't know. I would hope that they, you know, there must be some kind of
thing. Because day-old
there,
bagels
right?
are still good. You know, we eat them for a week. You buy, like, a bag of bagels, you might have them for a week.
I don't like bagels. I hate bagels. All bagels should be given to the homeless, in my opinion. Like, as soon as they come out of the oven, or how do you make a bagel? I don't know. Wherever they come from, just take them right to the homeless shelter.
It's boiled bread, isn't it?
Boiled bread.
I think that's why. I see. Yeah, that's why I thought it would be in your wheelhouse.
I knew there was a boiled chicken joke coming in somehow.
Boiled fluffy bread seems like right in your,
in my wheelhouse.
Really, you have an aversion to bagels. I didn't notice. I didn't know that about you.
Yeah. I guess
I should have just assumed.
I don't like. That's the same assumption. No, I think maybe you were right there. Like that could be in the wheelhouse. I think a while ago, some time ago now. This is. Maybe 2 years ago, I wrote an email to my friend Clayton, who is joining me here. This is his 166th appearance on The Grizz.
Yeah, it's thanks for having me.
Yeah, I appreciate you being on the program. You know, I always do. About 2 years ago, I wrote an email to my friend Clayton, and I had mentioned to him this nagging idea that I had. Now that I think about it, it might have been closer to 3 years ago, Clayton. I think it was not long after we had launched The Grizz, which, if I'm not mistaken, was what? That was 3 Septembers ago, right?
Yeah, yeah, almost going on 4.
Mm-hmm. So about 3 years ago, I wrote, and I meant this in a very sincere way, although I think you had dismissed it as being a joke because you never responded to this email.
Or maybe I was just digesting it.
Mm-hmm. I wrote to my friend and I said, you know, it's probably not possible given the divergent nature of our lives and the things that eat up our time and everything else, but if we were ever going to consider, for whatever strange reason, playing as a band again, we should consider it soon. And I think, you know, Clayton just thought that this is a ludicrous thought and didn't respond. But I think now I've lost track of how this tied back in. What were we just talking about a second ago?
Pies.
I don't know how this connects to pies.
I was going
to
say, pull this one together because I'm waiting for the day you mount here.
Pies and bacon. You're going to be. I don't remember now. I don't know how this ties back into pies or. Oh, yeah, I got it. Okay, so here we go. I wrote this to him, and I meant this very sincerely, but I think he took it as a joke. Generally, you know, some people do have a difficult time distinguishing between when I'm joking and when I'm not, but I would say Clayton's probably very, very, very close to the top of the list of the people who understands the difference.
I didn't think it was a joke, because if it's longer than a sentence and you've given it more than a minute of your time, I know that it's not a joke. I just didn't know how to respond because I was contemplating the very same idea after you. I just like, how can we make this work? In what way could this happen?
Right.
And I couldn't quite wrap my head around how it could happen. But go ahead. Mm-hmm.
So in any event, what I didn't get to in the postscript of that email was that I thought we would call the new concept album In My Wheelhouse. So that's where that tied back into bagels. Anyway, along the lines of music, let me bring this up here. By the way, this is the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe podcast. I don't know how you would have lasted this long not knowing this. This is the 166th episode. I'm Mike, and that's Clayton. Talking music recently, as last week we talked about the fact that we are trying to hunt down Thomas Dolby, who is perhaps best known for the 1982 hit She Blinded Me with Science. Of course, in his homeland, he's best known for his 1984 single Hyperactive, Thomas Dolby has released, just at the end of October, a new album called Map of the Floating City. And I have acquired a map of the floating city, this newest work from Thomas Dolby, and I love it. We had talked about the fact that we don't listen to a lot of current music or new stuff that's out there, and I realized Thomas Dolby, at least as an artist, seems kind of entrenched in the 80s. But the truth is, he's been active for a whole lot longer than that, and he's been up to all kinds of great and creative stuff. And I am stunned by how much I like this new Thomas Dolby album. You've heard some of it too, right?
Yeah, I have. Just some of the stuff I've clicked on. I haven't had a chance to sit down and put on some headphones and enjoy it, though. I may do that, though, on a nice walk. How would you describe it?
Based on some of the things I've read about it, it's intended as a concept album, and the whole story of this album takes place in an alternate history. The kind of foreboding way that he's put it in interviews, Dolby has said, if World War II went a very different way, it would result in this history where I've set this new album of mine, A Map of the Floating City. And that's like a really strange thing, right, to start an album off with.
Right.
I'm going to place this whole thing in an alternate reality. But it's kind of broken into three chunks, and he even released the music that way through EPs. Four of the songs, actually the first four tracks, were all wrapped up in part of like a viral marketing game that was designed for him by J.J. Abrams. But all together, then, these 11 tracks that make up the new album from Thomas Dolby, they're really diverse. Like, I can't stress enough, like, this is him really flexing his muscles, because he goes back and forth between like rock and a more electronic sound and some jazz stuff. He's just all over the place in this album, and I mean that in a good way. I know sometimes people say that to slag somebody off. I really, really like this new album of his. Some of my favorites on there, one of the jazzier songs is A Jealous Thing Called Love. I think there's also another, toward the end of the album, there's a jazzier song called Simone, which is also good. There's a really ethereal track called Oceania. But I also, among the others, this one's more like a straight up, I could almost hear this like on radio, Road to Reno.
Oh yeah, I was playing that the other day. I really like that. Yeah, I need to dive more into this because... You're speaking this highly of it. then I will need to check this out. Yeah, the ones are, I think I clicked on Road to Reno. And what was the other one we were playing the other day over Skype? You and I were chatting.
It might have been the one that caught my attention first was A Jealous Thing Called Love, because like the last thing I would expect from a Thomas Dolby album is a jazz song. Like, you just imagine it's going to have this hard-edged new wave electronic sound, and it doesn't. I mean, there is a little bit of that, especially like in the song Spice Train, which I think is the one they're trying to frame as the single, because I did see that there's an alternate version of it called Radio Edit, which, you know, I inferred from that that means that they must have tried to send it to radio. And I don't know. This is a guy who, you know, he's incredibly creative, and he's very diverse. You know, it's not as if he's only a musician. This guy does everything.
Yeah, I mean, just the people that he's played with. We were talking about this, of course, Roger Waters. I mean, he's played with...
David Byrne.
David Bowie, on and on and on.
Yeah. So, the more I listen to it, the more I really, really like this album. And, there have been a couple really pleasant surprises. You know, back in the summer months, right actually before we had John Flansburgh here on the program, They Might Be Giants released their, 9,000th studio album, Join Us, which was like a welcome breath of fresh air, because some of the more recent stuff from They Might Be Giants has not engaged me like their older stuff. And this seemed a lot like the older stuff.
Yeah, and even, the Cars this year with their new album. That is really, really enjoyable. And I play that album. My son dances to that album, and it's so good. I mean, I'd love to talk to Rick Ocasek, too, from the Cars, get him on the show at some point as well.
Yeah, I don't know why that guy seems so difficult to hunt down.
Yeah.
Like, he can't be all that busy. Like, I understand that you're going to be, if you're married to a supermodel, that keeps you busy. But are you so busy you can't come on the Grizz, Rick Ocasek?
Right. Like, you got to keep up appearances, you know? Mm-hmm. But, it'd be great to have him on. I don't know. Are we still talking music? Because you recently, you had a chance to finally listen to Mayer Hawthorne.
Yes.
Sent you that album. What'd you think? I mean, it's odd. I mean, it's different, right? I mean, here's a skinny white guy who sounds like he should be, I don't know, like a middle-aged black guy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't know that. I don't know what he looks like. You know, I don't know that about him. I just know, I didn't find his music offensive or anything, but it didn't really, like, win me over. Like, I got to get everything this dude's ever done.
Yeah. Yeah, there are a few songs, right? Like, I don't listen to the whole album. There are a few songs, and I'm like, wow, this is really interesting, really original. It's got quite a throwback sound to it.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly a great old soul sound that you just don't hear these days, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what's really struck me about Amy Winehouse's, was it Back to Black, her huge monster Grammy-winning CD?
I think that was an AC/DC album, actually.
You might be right, actually. Isn't Back to Black, what is the name of her album that won all the Grammys?
You're Back asking in Black? The wrong guy. I couldn't
tell Back
you.
To Black, is that an AC/DC song?
Back in Black, not Back to Black, but Back in Black, yeah. No, you're right, Back to Black, 6 Grammys, Well, 6 nominations, 5 wins.
I mean, that's one of those albums you just like, wow, where did this woman come from?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, to a lesser extent, I'm not trying to throw them all in the same category, so to speak, but like the first time I heard Duffy, and I'm not trying to say that she's like the be-all, end-all of, but like I thought her sound, and especially like her vocal quality, was really unique, and I was like, wow, I haven't heard anything like this. I felt that same way the first time I heard that first Norah Jones record.
Right,
you know,
right,
like
right,
Norah
right.
Jones just kind of came out of left field with a really different sound than everything else, and it's a shame. And I'll throw one more name into this category, Jane Monheit, who put out a handful of terrific jazz albums, now going back 10 or 11, 12 years. Norah Jones is one of them, and definitely Jane Monheit, where they came out really strong with a first album that I loved, and then like trailed off into boring music.
Yeah, I agree with you. And Norah Jones going off into that sort of semi-pop record that she did at one point, which was, I don't know, it was really bizarre. I bought it, and I listened to it one time, and I was sad that I bought it. It's sort of like some of these artists, like Harry Connick Jr., who decide, we're going to go off and try these different things, and just like, stick to what you're good at.
Yeah.
I guess who are we to say, right? I mean, this is, look at what we do, right? If someone were to say, hey, why don't you guys just stick with... Stick with this, right? I mean, God knows, you try everything, right? Things you enjoy, you evolve, right? Listen to what John Flansburgh said on our show.
Mm-hmm.
you know, he doesn't really think about the early stuff. He wants to do things that are interesting to him and John. Like, that's what they want to do. Mm-hmm. They're not so worried about trying to get back to some sound from when, you know, from whence they came. Right. But Harry Connick Jr. wanted to try new things, did, you know, Star Turtle, some other albums in there, pop.
Well, I think that first one where he really veered off the rails was She in 94. Because he had... There were those albums where he was doing, like, standards and jazz instrumentals and that kind of stuff, right? There were a handful of those. He did the thing with the trio, Lofty's Roach Souffle. And then he had some more conventional stuff that Clayton and I really, really liked. We Are in Love and Blue Light, Red Light in particular seem most emblematic of that, of the stuff that he was doing that was really, like, all right. Then, after those two, which were pretty close together, I think they were only a year or two apart, his next real, like... you know, not another album of instrumentals or not a Christmas album or that kind of stuff, was She, which came out in 1994, where he had this new backup band. Were they called, like, Funky Donkey or something?
Oh, God, I don't remember.
And it was, like, a radical departure. Like, it was more like, not even Memphis. Like, it was even more like a New Orleans funk sound than it was jazz. And what's weird, I remember this, I think this is fair of you too. I'm not going to put words in your mouth, so contradict me here. We did not like this album when it came out.
She?
Right.
Yeah, no, No, because I've been a bigger fan. You know, when you come up and really enjoying, like, Blue Light, Red Light, or We Are in Love, those early sort of jazz standard albums that he was doing.
Right, but those were, most of them were songs that he did write, though. They weren't, you know, there were a couple jazz standards on there, but those were original Connick compositions.
Right, and I would even say, like, his album 25, you know, was still true to that sort of jazz standard. He had some jazz standards, like Caravan and some other songs that, of course,
the ones that are
his.
Named for his ages.
Right.
20, 25, 30. Those are the ones that are typically, like, jazz standards and instrumentals.
So all of the stuff, or most of the stuff he had written on We Are in Love and Blue Light, Red Light, certainly, I mean, that's the stuff that I remembered him. So suddenly he comes out with, like, a rock album, like a funky... Like a funky rock album, and you're like, "What is this?"
Yeah,
and you know, and that's the sort of stuff that turns you off. Like, and I will say, like, this new Black Keys album, which I haven't purchased just yet, called El Camino, which everyone's praising. Of course, it's the number one record in the country right now. It is a bit of a departure, you know, because they come up on the first, at least on the Black Keys album, Brothers, that won all the Grammys, a very blues sound. And then this new album apparently is a little bit of a departure from that blues originality. You know, these two white guys singing some blues stuff. But it's incredible. I mean, just the tonality that they've managed to come up with, just the two of them, is really remarkable. So, but again, a little bit of a departure. So I was reading through some of the iTunes reviews of some, you know, longtime fans. And they're like, you know, if you're a longtime Black Keys fan, you may be a little disappointed that they've moved a little bit away from blues and stuff. So you're never going to please everyone. What do you want people to keep churning out the same album for 30 years, you know, where it just begins to sound trite?
Right. Well, I understand that. And I want to say this about She. Going back and listening to it now, I like She. But at the time, I didn't like it, and it was for the reason that Clayton just mentioned there, is that I wanted the third part of the We Are in Love, Blue Light, Red Light, you know, Imagine trilogy in my brain that never came to be. I wanted another album of that aesthetic, and that wasn't forthcoming. That wasn't what Connick wanted to do next, obviously. So he did this very funky album, which disappointed my expectations. That's not to say the album was a disappointment. It just means it disappointed my expectations. And when I go back and listen to it now, I like She. I like a lot of the songs on there. But it, for me, that was where I started to, like, lose interest in Harry Connick. Like, I was very, very interested in him for that, you know, it was 2 or 3 years where he was putting out albums that I really liked the sound of. And then when he started to deviate from that, I kind of got away from it. And, you know, he's certainly not the only artist that that's true of. I definitely went through that with Chris Isaak, where I had this period where I really liked everything Chris Isaak was doing. Right. And then he just kind of started to go off in a slightly different direction, which did not interest me as much. And I almost, like, I turned on Chris Isaak. Like, I was like, yeah. Oh, I can't even stand listening to Chris Isaak anymore.
Yeah, you started stalking him. You went to his house.
I did.
Threatened him. Threatened his dog.
Mm-hmm. I said, I'm going to fix that little thing on your chin. Whatever that is.
That little dimple.
Yeah.
You remember the Chris Isaak show?
I never saw it, right? Because I think it was on Prism.
It was Prism. Does that even exist anymore?
No, it doesn't. It was like on Stars or one of those channels no one gets, right? Did you hear there's a new awesome show on Stars? I'll get it on DVD afterward because no one buys Stars.
It's entertaining. I mean, because he's...
He has a really dry sense of humor, does Chris Isaak. And I think that show was like his showcase for it.
It was interesting because he'd have different artists on, you know, whom he admired and such, and he'd want to, you know, do some different interviews with them and chat them up and some different things. And then he'd play some music with them. I don't know if like Elvis Costello or just some pretty popular artists and things. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting hearing him as a musician interview other musicians, you know, sort of like that Elvis Costello show that was, you know, fairly interesting when he interviewed the Police and who else was on that Elvis Costello show? It's the only one I ever watched.
Oh, he had I'm not a huge Elton John fan, but he had a fascinating interview with Elton John. He all too briefly had Nick Lowe. Nick Lowe was like sandwiched in with four other artists. I think that is coming back on for yet another season, that Elvis Costello show that's on, not Bravo, but
Ion or something.
Yeah, that's going to drive me nuts now that I can't. Hey, real quick, a bit of trivia about Harry Connick's album She that I just found as I was looking around. Did you know one of the standout songs on there, I Could Only Whisper Your Name? Did you know that he released that as a single, and that was the highest charting single of his career?
I Can Only Whisper Your Name off of She?
Yes, that is the highest charting Harry Connick single ever.
Mm.
Very interesting, right?
Yeah, I believe that because, you know, there's not a lot of crossover appeal when you have some of these jazz standards. I mean, you know, think about some of the songs that you would label as jazz, right? Like a Louis Armstrong song, like Hello Dolly, right? It's technically, it's jazz because it's coming from Louis Armstrong, but it's not. It's a pop song. It's a popular song, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So then, of course, what Hello Dolly is famous for, I think, knocking off the Beatles at number one, like on the charts, 1963, 1964.
Mm. Hey, by the way, here, I did find some information. It's the Sundance Channel here in the U.S. that airs Spectacle with Elvis Costello. And so far, there have just been two seasons. So among the guests that they've had, and I've seen most of these, actually, as I'm scanning down, they're very, very interesting. Even if you would think the subject of the interview is not very interesting, something about watching them with Costello is very, very interesting. He's had Elton John, Lou Reed, James Taylor, Tony Bennett, The Police, Rufus Wainwright, Herbie Hancock, Diana Krall, Smokey Robinson, Bono and Edge. There are several where there are a bunch of people lumped together, including one that has both Nick Lowe and Richard Thompson together. Why these guys couldn't get their own episodes, I don't know. There's a Lyle Lovett episode and two parts of Bruce Springsteen. Hmm. So, I don't know. Maybe it looks like it's not coming back for a third season, which is disappointing because the ones I watched, I thought it was a fascinating show. And that's on the Sundance Channel in the U.S.,
it was certainly worth it. I loved watching that Police interview. You know, that was fascinating. You know, they're contemporaries. So there's a certain amount of, you know, the artists who are being interviewed give Elvis Costello a certain amount of rope to hang himself with, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's that, he sort of is able to get his foot in the door ahead of time with an interview, which I think was interesting. The reason I bring that up is because my wife said, I think Alec Baldwin has his own podcast. Have you heard about this?
It wouldn't surprise me.
Where he just interviews random celebrities, which is, you know, bizarre. Alec Baldwin interviewing celebrities, but apparently it's a little odd.
Well, I think he's probably a little odd himself.
Yeah. So anyway, did you happen to catch, what was I going to ask you? Oh, so the other day, well, I should mention this. We're going to, very, very lucky, I'm hoping very, very soon, we're going to have Saturday Night Live star and alumnus, Daryl Hammond, on the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be really, really exciting.
It is, and I would like to say this, and I'm not saying this just because he's coming on the show, because I've probably said it on previous Grizzes as well. I think he is up there alongside of Phil Hartman as, like, the top tier of all-time SNL performers. When he's part of the cast, he's the glue that holds those shows together. I thought that of Phil Hartman when he was on, and that is also true of Daryl Hammond as well.
Yeah, so that'll be exciting to have Daryl Hammond on the show to talk about. He has a new book coming out.
I thought it was out.
Oh, yeah, I think it is out, yeah. But it's fascinating. His time with Saturday Night Live, he talks about quite a bit. His tales of stand-up comedy. He was actually in prison for a time, if you can believe that.
Yes, yes.
So he's going to come on the show to talk about that.
About prison,
about a bunch of other stuff. Yeah.
He just wants to clear the air about prison. He really doesn't want to talk about anything else. So.
But speaking of stand-up, well, actually, let's talk about stand-up in a second, because I have some things I wanted to run by you that I had watched for the first time in a little while, and I want to see if you actually caught them on Netflix. So we'll talk about some stand-up comedy here in just a moment. But first, why don't you tell us about our good show sponsors at gazelle.com?
No.
Do it. Do it before I come through this microphone. I'll turn this podcast around.
I will pull this thing over right now, mister. So, as Clayton said there, I'd like to tell you about Gazelle.com. They are a fantastic show sponsor of ours, and they offer a service that both Clayton and I have used. Here is how it works. You gather up these things about your house that you no longer use, a cell phone, an MP3 player, any type of electronic good, right? DVD player, whether it's related to music, camera, video, whatever. In fact, there's over 250,000 different items that Gazelle.com would like to purchase from you. So you just go right to their website, you tell them what you've got, you tell them what condition it's in, and they're going to make you an offer. They say, well, we think this pile of stuff you've got, or could be just one item, is worth so many dollars. And if you accept, in the next 30 days, what you'll do is you'll print out this prepaid shipping label that they'll email right to you, you box it up, and off it goes to Gazelle headquarters. They'll evaluate the items to make sure that they are what you describe them to be, and then they're going to issue you a payment, whether it's by PayPal or paper check. You'll get an extra 5% if you choose an Amazon.com gift card. There's a variety of options there, and you'll discover, as I have, that it's really quite painless. It's very simple. It's a great way to monetize some of this otherwise worthless clutter you have lying about your house, especially around the holidays. It couldn't hurt to have a couple extra bucks in your pocket. Two important things you need to know about Gazelle.com. One, if the goods you have are obsolete or otherwise without value, they'll still take them off your hands. They'll recycle them in a responsible way so you don't have to worry about how do I dispose of these gizmos. They also wipe it of all your personal information so you needn't fear identity theft. You should also know that in the event that the goods that you send in are worth more money than what they had originally estimated, they will pay you that difference. That's happened to me, and it's happened to Clayton, too. They're very honest, they make it very simple, and I like using them. And if we didn't like them, the simple matter is we wouldn't have them on this show as a sponsor. We will not endorse anything here on the Grizz that we don't like and use personally. And it's two thumbs up, or in fact four if you count Clayton's thumbs as well, for Gazelle.com. When you're checking out on that last screen, they may ask you how you heard about them. Please make sure to indicate it was through the Clayton Morris Podcasting Network. That's right. So we get some credit. Thank you, Gazelle.com, for your long-standing sponsorship of us here at GrizzlyProductions.tv.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Gazelle. Hey, I got a question for you, just top of mind here.
Top of mind.
Do you remind? I mean, you spend a lot of time in locker rooms, right?
I guess.
Well, with your car, right? You're constantly in locker rooms with other men.
Well, let me tell you this. You know, I would say it's quite rare that we're actually in what is a true locker room. Like a lot of times, these dressing areas that we have to appropriate, we call them the locker room, but they really aren't. Yeah. You know, it's like a service closet.
Right. Yeah. So you guys get changed in like what's like a kitchen or a pantry sometimes.
Right. I mean, you just got to, you know, make use of the space, whatever you've got. It's really quite rare that we get a proper locker room.
Yeah. Well, the reason this is top of mind is because I actually joined a gym, which I can't believe I've done.
Yeah.
But I feel like I've seen some weight sort of ticking up over the past couple of months. Mm-hmm. Even after, like, I'd lost a lot of weight and I was down to, like, my fighting weight of, like, 180, which is where I wanted to be. And then I tricked back up again. Now I'm at, like, 192. Mm-hmm. Like, how did that happen? How does it just like slowly happen, right? You just keep eating and you just feel like, well, I put on that pound. What's an extra pound, right? Then it just snowballs. And pretty soon I'm going to wind up on one of those AMC shows where I'm stuck in a couch, you know, and I'm not leaving the house and my mom's bringing me Chinese food every 5 minutes to eat. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, it's a vicious cycle. So anyway,
is that it? That's the end of that? Yeah.
Yeah, that's the end of the story. No, but I joined this gym and I forgot, like, I'm not a big fan of being naked in a locker room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I hearken back to our days, like, playing water polo and getting changed, you know, in the locker room. But, like, it's weird, you know, and you're, like, standing next to some other dude who's, like, standing there naked. Mm-hmm. And there's some guys who are, like, comfortable naked.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You know these guys?
I'm familiar with them, yes.
Are you one of them?
Do you want me to tell you their names? Oh, no, I'm not, you know, I'm not like the guy. This is the difference. There are the guys that you will get undressed and dressed into whatever you're changing into as rapidly as possible. And then they contrast those against the guys that will walk around and converse with you while naked.
Right, exactly.
Hey, buddy, did you catch the Eagles game yesterday?
Right.
I actually – go ahead. Tell your story.
No,
I have
– go ahead.
No, I got to recall the way – I actually had a – it was perfect in my brain. I'll tell it to you in a second. You tell your story.
So I joined this gym, and I'm in the locker room. And, yeah, I just don't – you know, then I went in the steam room and everything because I'm this cold. I just cannot get rid of this thing. So I worked out, came down. And I've gone for about a few weeks now, you know. But I couldn't wait to get back into the steam room. But, the process for me is I like just getting the locker, go in, open the thing, put my coat in there. And I've already got my prepackaged sort of workout clothes on, right? Whether it's like track pants or maybe I've got some shorts underneath the track pants. I just pull those off and I'm ready to go. There are people, though, who bring like entire sports bags full of like a new outfit, new underwear, which strikes me like that's the type of thing you would do.
Hmm.
Like you couldn't possibly, as anal as you are, like put on like, you know, the same underwear that you just worked out in back on after like a workout shower.
Of course not. No.
You probably have three pairs, like the pair you wear to the gym, the pair you'll wear working out, and then the third pair that you'd wear going home.
Correct, and a fourth in case of emergency.
Right, in case you get scared on the drive home. But there are people, you know, they bring their big gym bags, and then they do everything at the gym, right? They shave. Like, this gym is big, you know? Mm. And I think actually some of the New Jersey, or the New York Jets actually work out at the same gym, apparently, I've been told. So, you know, they have like – and they have like mouthwash. They have like lotion. You know, they have all that sort of stuff. They have like hair dryers. They have Q-tips. They have razors. They have the single-edge razors. I felt like stealing a bag for you for Christmas because you use those disposable razors. You know, they got shaving cream, the big vat of shaving cream. And they have like 30 sinks, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So there are people there who will like go and get all ready and then they go to the office from there. Like that's too much work for me. Like, I just need to go and then come home and shower and stuff. But the other day I decided, you know, I'm going to take advantage of the facilities I'm paying for. So, you know, got in the steam room after I worked out, and that was beautiful, you know, fantastic. I was able to breathe a little easier. But I had to get naked first. Mm. And I just don't – and there was, like, a dude next to me. Like, he happened to have, like, the locker next to me. And so there was nowhere for me to go because I needed to get my stuff out of my locker. So I'm, like, having to change. And I just, like, quickly try to do everything I can do before my junk is out there. You know what I mean? Like, I'm trying to – all right, I can put my phone in my locker. I put the keys in there. I've got the towel ready. It's ready to go, right? I'm ready to grab it and just wrap it around me because I don't want anyone – like, what am I worried about?
Mm-hmm.
Like, someone snapping a photo?
Right. Well, that does happen in those locker rooms all the time.
Someone, you know, catching a look and asking for my number? Like, I don't even know what I'm scared of. Or just someone comparing, I guess.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Like, saying, yeah, he's, you know – maybe someone – then they compare and they're like, oh, now they're feeling better about themselves.
You can't have that.
You know, I don't want that. I don't want someone feeling better about themselves from looking at me.
No, good thinking.
So, you know, I have it all laid out ready to go. Like I strip down, throw the workout underwear in the locker, the t-shirt, and then, you know, you zip around and just grab the towel real fast. You know, do the tuck. You know, just grab it and wrap around your waist and do the tuck in. Mm-hmm. And then go into the steam room. So then I'm naked. You know, I'm naked under there, underneath the towel.
Right,
then I go to the shower, you know, into the shower stall, and then I throw the towel up there. But then I was worried. It's like, what if someone grabs the towel over the door of the shower? Like, who's going to do that? Like, what's my fear?
Mm-hmm.
Really? Like, someone – and then what's the fear? Like, that I'd have to walk 30 feet back to the other side of the locker room naked?
Yeah.
Like, it's all men, right?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Like, back in the day when we were first introduced to this very bizarre ritual of changing together like that, like, as Clayton said, we were like on a water polo team with other junior high kids. Like, of course that's what they did, right? Of course the idiot on our water polo team would steal your towel and run away so you had to walk the 30 feet back naked. You know what I mean?
Right. Now, like, these are all businessmen, so they're not going to do that.
Well, that's the thing. Like, the fear, you know what I mean? It's irrational, right? I mean, a lot of those types of gut emotions like that, they're irrational. So that doesn't change, you know, the fact that we're 20 years older now or whatever, you know, none of that changes. You know, the fact that Louis Cintron stole your towel and came up and made a Flaccid Friday comment to you 20 years ago, you know, like, now I can't go to the gym and change.
Flaccid Friday.
In front of, you know.
So I need to get over this fear. It's been a while. This has been one of the reasons why I haven't wanted to like join a gym. I'm just like, you know, do I want to go through that? But there's like this whole – there's a whole sort of etiquette to the gym locker room. You know, you don't pick the locker next to the guy who's already naked. You literally walk to the next whole set of lockers just so you can avoid the naked guy.
Right.
But there's some guys – like there's like this large kind of Play-Doh-y looking guy who was there just kind of hanging out. You know, he's just like – he's swishing his mouthwash around. He's putting on aftershave. He's just kind of hanging there with his like white pasty behind sticking out for a while. And like, like, I'm as fast as I possibly can be. You know, like, what's the purpose? Like, who you – you know. just enjoy it that much. You just want to hang out like that for that long.
Mm.
Like, just wrap it up, man. Just wrap it up fast. So this is something I'm working on. Like, I thought I'd like to be – I wouldn't mind being one of those guys who can bring a bag. You know, bring a bag and, like, he goes to the gym and in his track outfit. Then he works out. Then you know, he showers and he shaves and he uses the mouthwash. He has the combs, the extra combs they have there. And he looks all buffed and clean. And he leaves and he's like, now I'm on my way to the office. You know, I wish I could be like one of those guys, but I just can't.
I don't know that I'd want. I don't aspire to that at all. I'm content to let somebody else be that guy. I don't.
But you're not the naked guy in the locker room. Like you're the fast.
No.
You're the quick change artist in the Chikara locker room.
Well, just in general, like, you know, it's got to happen rapidly. You know, that's what I'm saying. I would never be. You know, there's always that old guy that's like, I'm comfortable with my body, and I'm just going to come up and talk to you about random stupid things.
Like Will Ferrell, like instead, like he just put
yes.
he put his leg up like on a bench,
right,
with
exactly.
his junk hanging out.
And one of the fears, this is a legitimate fear, would be that, of course, if you're stuck next to one of these people while they're buck naked and they were to drop something while reaching over to get it, you might have butt-to-butt contact briefly. And that's not – you cannot have that. That's an untenable situation in any male locker room.
What's that called, a moon landing?
You're right about that. I don't know why I know that, but you're right about that.
I bet in a Chikara locker room, you come with your singlet already underneath your clothes, right? Like Superman.
No, sometimes when I train, though, like if I'm going somewhere, whether it's a regular practice or like I'm teaching a seminar somewhere, I show up with, because I usually do wear a singlet underneath my training stuff. It's just more comfortable. You know, like I wouldn't train in boxer shorts. I have the singlet underneath because that can be a bit of a chore. And you never know, right? You get someplace and maybe there isn't a changing room. So better to be prepared, because then there's like this awkward towel dance that you have to do to make that happen. But,
did you recall your story?
So every once and again, not all the time, like twice a year tops, I'm in line at the post office or the bank or the grocery store or something, and like some guy, I think maybe it has to do with what I'm wearing on that day, you know, like maybe I have a flannel shirt on, he'll say something like, hey man, you see those Eagles yesterday? And the reason people say that is because in the greater Philadelphia area, there's a football team called the Eagles, and some people care about that stuff. And they think that strangers care about it, too. But, of course, we don't. We don't care about it. But it's always awkward for me because I can't say that at that moment, you know, like while I'm pondering, do I want the chunky or do I want the Twix? You know, I can't be like, you know, no one really cares about legitimate sport, right? That's so 10 years ago. instead, you know, like I have to fumble. So my Pat, you know, oh, no, man, I didn't see the game. And then sometimes this guy, the, you know, other person, will go into a story about, like, a highlight from the game or something. Oh, man, the fourth, man, they threw the brown ball. One guy caught it at the end and everyone cheered or whatever. You know, who cares? And it's annoying to me because I don't have a real – like, I wish I had, like, a snippy, kind of snarky, maybe doesn't sink in till 30 seconds later and I'm gone already type comment for that. And I had one the other day because – the guy in line was not talking about the Eagles. He was talking about some other team, and I had like it just came to me like bang, and I hit it and walked out, and I was like, yeah, that was great. But I can't think of it. I can't think of what the comment was, and it had to do with the team, but it wasn't the Eagles. He was asking about a different football team, not from the greater Philadelphia area. So I can't think of what the team is, and it's ruining it. That's the story. I finally had the great comeback, and I can't recount it to you now.
From the Philadelphia area.
No, that's what I'm saying. He was a fan of a different football team. Hmm. Not the Eagles is the name of the one here in Philly, Clayton.
Right.
There's a different team from some other city that he liked. And he brought that up in line. And I had, for example, to give you what I imagine in my mind is, like when hey man, you see the Eagles? I would say something witty about Don Henley and Glenn Frey, and I would leave. And like 30 seconds later, he'd be like, oh, that dude thought I meant Eagles the band, because people really care about that.
Right.
I never have that, but I did have it, and I can't recount it to you now. Did you get – I mailed you a DVD. Did you get it?
I did. Mm-hmm. and the way Mike mails a DVD is that – well, first of all, you know, DVDs, like they come in a nice hard-shelled plastic case.
Yeah, plastic clamshell.
So Mike, you know, wraps it in a – first of all, a nice post office box, number one. So it's in a box. So it can't be, you know, sat upon unless somebody actually grabs it and sits on it. It'll be protected. But mm-hmm. then you also place it inside a level like a comic bag. Yes. Like, we're, you know, instead of a backer board, like, just in the comic bag. And then you wrap it.
Yes.
You know, and then when I get it, of course, I immediately, you know, take it out and I rest like a coffee cup on top of it. Just to spite you. Yeah, so I did
throw
receive
it in the sink.
So it's the documentary, and I guess we'll probably talk about it maybe on an upcoming Grizz here, and I'm trying to watch it this week when I have some time, because I'm off for the holiday. It's the documentary on Showbiz Pizza Place.
Yes.
Which I cannot believe that someone funded and then produced this film.
Yes. I agree. So you may recall that there a couple Grizzes ago, this happened to come up as Showbiz Pizza Place factored into our childhood, and apparently did for lots of other people, because at one time there was it maxed out at around 200 stores. There were 200 Showbiz Pizza Place restaurants active at one time in the U.S. And not to ruin some of the information you might discover in the documentary, and it's a very easy 70-minute watch, but and I was largely ignorant of this, and I was especially ignorant of the fact that there's like a fan following for the band from Showbiz Pizza Place, which was called the Rockafire Explosion. Now, I remember that there was a band, and I could even remember, like, the guy who was also the mascot of Showbiz Pizza Place was this bear called Billy Bob who wore striped overalls. I could picture him and a couple of the other characters, but I really didn't remember the name of the band at all.
No, not at all.
So the fact that there's like this devoted online fan following for the Rockafire Explosion really caught me off guard. It was brought to my attention by a friend of mine, Zia, who sent me some links. One led me to this documentary. And then also, you know, so a couple things you need to know. Those animatronic bands, those robots that make up the Rockafire Explosion, you know, they had to make a set of those, of course, for every Showbiz Pizza, right? Like there was one in every restaurant.
Sure.
No matter where you went.
So I picture like the Tinkerer from Batman, you know, like building these things, right? And he gives them all personality somehow, or someone, you know, like the guy who was it Moriarty who built Data on Star Trek Next Generation.
Oh yeah, look at you busting it out, Moriarty. Oh, hey, by the way, just to tie this back into the thing we talked about in the very beginning, go watch the last episode of Batman: The Brave and the Bold, so you can see the neon Bat Street Luge.
Awesome.
You've got to see him in that sled. Anyway.
And to tie it back to pies also. So go ahead. Rockafire Explosion.
That's the name of our concept album, In My Wheelhouse. So I watched this documentary, and it's fascinating. The whole idea of it's fascinating. These robots, when the time came, and what they discovered was, and this will be told to you by the guy who's behind the animatronics that were in the Showbiz Pizza Place, a guy named Aaron. He was a very well-spoken guy. You know, he explained that about the time that they got to half capacity, that is to say, when they got to about 100 restaurants operating, they became aware of the fact that they were actually losing money, that the Showbiz Pizza Place franchise, which was financed by a hotel corporation, was actually losing money. And what ultimately ended up happening, the demise of these, as we lamented a few Grizzes ago, was that most Showbiz Pizza Places in the years to follow were converted into Chuck E. Cheese's. And what actually happened was, although the physical mechanics of these animatronic robots stayed in place, their outer skins were changed to be different characters. So what was once maybe a gorilla, when you would go into the Chuck E. Cheese, had been changed over and was made to look like a mouse. Things like that. So the documentary, it talks a little bit about that. It does not, I'll say this, it does not have anywhere near like the amount of statistics and stuff that I really want from a documentary. It's really kind of about the Aaron's story, as the guy who created it, and the story of the greatest fan of the Rockafire Explosion, who is one of several lucky fans actually own, like, how do I want to put it, decommissioned sets of the Rockafire Explosion animatronic band. That is to say, he has the robots in his house.
That's crazy.
So that was fascinating to me. I also looked online because, as I said, you know, there's a big online following for this. A couple things that you should know about the Rockafire Explosion. One, some versions of the band still exist, and what they do is they'll reprogram them. You know, they reprogram the movements of the robots and choreograph new routines to modern songs. This led to a strange circumstance I recently discovered, because after Clayton and I were talking about some, you know, bands not unlike the Black Keys, and one in particular, MGMT, I YouTubed an MGMT video that I wanted to watch for one of their most popular songs called Electric Feel, which is kind of like a weird song that somehow gets stuck in your brain but really doesn't, like, I can't explain it. It's a very sticky sticky song, though. I'm watching the video, right? This is like right after we had concluded that week's Grizz. And there's one of the animatronic robots from Showbiz Pizza Place in the video. The real video by the band.
That's and I'm crazy. Thinking,
I was like, you got to be kidding me. Like, I haven't had a conversation with any other human being about Showbiz Pizza Place in easily 15 years.
Right.
And the same time, and here it's in the band that we were talking about in the Grizz. Like, this is insane. Then I find out there's another video that's been watched millions of times on YouTube of the Rockafire explosion reprogrammed to play Electric Feel by MGMT. And I'm thinking, what is going on here? Like, you know, it's like the entropy's opened up and swallowing the universe. And there's Hal right. Jordan. He's Parallax. Why is he at the end there? Barbara Gordon's alive again. Anyway, so
that is
very,
weird.
Very strange. Right. I mean, I didn't expect to see Hal there. So that's all very weird in how that ties together. And there's still, and people do own these things. And I found online, it was not eBay. It was like an alternate eBay. It was like a weird, like, we're not eBay, but we are thing. Where someone was selling their Rockafire explosion, complete set of all the robots, all the animatronics, and everything you need to run them. Starting bid was $305,000.
God.
Yeah.
You got a picture that those things too, and I'm just picturing how they worked, you know, and you would see mm-hmm. like the guy playing guitar, Billy Bob, the big bear singing, and his mouth would pop open and his eyes would blink, and you know, they'd move the bodies and shake. Like, those gotta break a lot.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I think they require some maintenance.
So I bet there's a guy. Wouldn't it be fascinating to find the Showbiz Pizza repairman guy who probably specialized in fixing these things?
Right. Well, I think, to be fair, it probably is Aaron. I think because his, you know, the communication that he has with people through websites and everything else is helping them solve, you know, he's still involved in animatronics. He has like a kit that he sells, you know, people that want to reprogram them. He gives them tips on how to do it because he understands how all the parts work. And this is a correlation that something I had to piece together myself when the documentary was over. He talks about Aaron, the creator of the Rockafire explosion and these animatronic robots. The fact that the reason that they're up on a stage or there's always something underneath them is because all of the animatronic pieces, that is to say, where the air gets pushed to move the parts, you know, they blow hot air through certain things and it makes the character move this way, and then the air comes from a different direction and moves them in an opposite direction, etc. All the equipment that does that, you know, all the compressors and everything else that blow the air that make the animatronic robots move have to be concealed underneath them. So that's why they're up on a stage. But what you might remember, and I certainly remember about Showbiz Pizza Place, was under the stage there was a little maze where kids could play. But it was always incredibly hot in there. And that's because between the maze and the stage were all these compressors blowing hot air were. And after he explained that, I'm like, that's why that maze was always so hot. Because the hot air compressors were right there. That was my big takeaway from the documentary.
That's all you got from it. Although I will say, it seems like all mazes where kids crawl through are always hot. So there must always be a Rockafire explosion band on top of it.
Right? How many other mazes populated by children were you ever in other than the one under the stage of Showbiz Pizza Place?
The Franklin Institute, the giant heart.
Mm, okay.
That always smelled bad. And
it did smell bad.
And still was does. Hot. McDonald's Playlands. Trying to think. Maybe that's it.
Outside. The Playlands were typically outside, though, right?
Just the giant heart. Yeah. Then maybe it was just a giant heart. Those sorts of things always kind of creep me out. Because even then I realized, like, there's got to be a lot of germs on these plastic things, right?
That's what 7-year-old Clayton Morris was saying.
Like, this ventricle's got to be disgustingly dirty, mm-hmm. you know? Got to get so... And you know the guy that's cleaning the Franklin Institute at night's not in there, you know, scrubbing down the... You know, he's like, oh, I'm just going to get the aorta tonight. I want to go home and watch the Eagles game.
ends up right behind me at the grocery store.
Yeah. Hey, I watched a documentary. Oh, not a documentary. I watched some stand-up.
Mm.
There's a whole bunch of new stuff on Netflix, finally. Mm. And there's some stuff that's dropped off Netflix, but some of the stuff that interests me. Like, if you haven't caught Walking Dead Season 1, it's out now on Netflix. Mm.
But that's not stand-up comedy, Clayton. That's a drama.
No, it's very, very funny. But then also Jake Johansson, his 2010 special. Now, did you tell me you saw this?
Is it called I Love You?
Yes.
Yes, I have seen that.
And I can say it's not that funny.
Right.
I was sorely disappointed. I mean, there were a couple of funny moments in there. Certainly when he was talking about, like, babies and having relationships.
He has a lot of material that's about him and his wife.
Yeah.
And a baby.
Right.
There's a lot more of that material than he had when last we saw Jake Johansson doing stand-up.
Yeah. So, you know, it's weird, and I wasn't terribly...
It was uncomfortable at times. And, like, when they would show his parents in the audience, like... You know, like, he'd tell some joke about, like, so this is what my wife and I were doing last night in the sack, and then they'd, like, go to his parents. I'm like, this is very uncomfortable.
But apparently he's a great writer, which I didn't realize. And I was talking to, who's going to be on here on The Grizz, I was actually having a conversation with Daryl Hammond off of The Grizz, and he said he's unfortunately never had the chance to work with Jake Johansson. And he said he has a lot of, he admires him quite a bit, and he thinks he's a great writer. But I also watched the other night a stand-up special that I hadn't seen from a few years ago, and it's why is it I'm missing it now? Shoot, somebody that we like a lot, and it's not Brian Regan,
Bob Odenkirk,
not Bob Odenkirk. It was Clayton, think, use your head.
I like that little pep talk that you just gave yourself there.
Yeah. Oh, I know, Norm Macdonald.
Yes.
Hilarious stand-up special called Me Doing Stand-Up. And it's like a year old, I think. Very, very funny. It's not even a year old. Maybe it's less than that, but very, very funny. And he's funny as ever. So, and I started following him on Twitter the other day. He's very funny on Twitter, by the way. And he and Steve Martin, both very, very funny on Twitter. So, have you seen the new? Have you seen the new special?
The new Norm Macdonald one. No,
very fun.
I did get his CD. I mean, now that probably came out 6-7 years ago. That CD of his, that was like absolutely hysterical. There was like a Superman skit on there. There was a Fantastic Four one. There was one about. It kept coming back again. I think Will Ferrell was in it with him. Like the world's first gay couple was like a recurring bit on this CD of his, and there was one about a gay country singer. That was kind of a slow burn. It was like a 13-minute bit, but it was hysterical. So
he did a bit about he's like Uncle Bob or his Uncle Blaine or something like that. He's got bowel cancer. He's like back in the day. Back in the day, they people just got sick. You know, they just got sick and then they died, right? He's like now when someone gets like cancer, they're always in a courageous battle. And he goes on this whole bit about how people now, they don't just get cancer and they deal with it and they go to the hospital. Now everyone's waging a courageous battle. And he says, I don't know what they mean. He goes, I go to the hospital and Uncle Blaine's just there waging a courageous battle. And he's got this thing up his, up his rear and he's sitting there, he's got this thing in his arm and he's flipping through the chat and he's just watching Matlock in the hospital bed. And that's his courageous battle. He's like, so to make his courageous battle a little easier, I just went out and bought him a box set of Matlock. very, very funny. And then he does a whole bit about how men, think about sex every 7.5 seconds. And he's like,
Staggering statistic.
And he goes, you just got to be smarter just by throwing in decimal points. He's like, just round it up. And he's like, and that's not true. He's like, men don't think about it that much. He's like, we walked down the street.
I wonder who the men were that were in that survey. How did they arrive at that?
Like, and how do they, devote any other time in their life to anything else other than that? That's his point. He's like, there's not a lot going on up there in our heads. Right. You walk down the street, he's like, that's a building. Oh, look at that. That's a nice building. Look at that guy over there. He's got cowboy boots on. Wonder if I'd look good in cowboy boots. Nah, I'm too tall. There's that building again. He's like, I couldn't possibly be thinking about sex every 7.5 seconds. I'd never get anything done.
Yeah.
So, very funny special. So,
If you do wish to go out, however, and find something that's very funny that is by Jake Johansson, as opposed to his more recent special, I Love You, which I, too, found to be a bit disappointing, go back and find his early 90s special, This'll Take About an Hour, which I think is one of the funniest stand-up specials of all time. I rank it up there with Dennis Miller's Black and White.
I think the night I saw that, it changed my life.
Yes.
It's a special that wanted me, I mean, and apart from loving, you know, Seinfeld growing up, that is Jerry Seinfeld before even his show. That is the special that got me into stand-up comedy. Mm-hmm. And I think in many ways shaped my entire career. It's mm-hmm. just such a clever, clever show.
Mm-hmm. We should get Jake on after, you know, Thomas Dolby, Daryl Hammond, and everybody else. And we'll get Aaron, the Showbiz Pizza Place guy. After that, we'll get Jake Johansson on to berate him about his most recent comedy special. But before we do any of that, Clayton, look at the time. You need to talk about Cobra.
Yeah, we got to talk about Cobra Eye Radar because we're almost out of the show today. We're almost out of time. And we got a Guilty Pleasure song. I think it's our second to last of the year.
Mm-hmm. Dave Stein's in the back of the club with the flashlight, Clayton.
Flagging us, saying, hey, you got to get off the stage.
Get off the stage.
But we're just riffing, man.
Mm-hmm. Wanda said I could riff.
We covered everything today. We covered pies. We covered toboggans. We covered being naked. It's a wide-ranging episode. Mm-hmm. Something for everyone.
Really?
Touched my heart. But let's talk about Cobra. Fine folks at Cobra Electronics. I have recently received, literally, about 30 tweets from people. Said, hey, what is that thing you guys tell us about? That tag thing? What is that? What is that? I want to get one. I need to get mm-hmm. one. I need to get one for my wife. Or my wife, I need to get one for my husband. So one of those two, you know, two genders. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we've had any transgendered folks write us, but it's usually one of the two of them.
Right. Well, it's tough to know that on Twitter.
Right. I mean, you look at their avatar, you think, that's got to be a husband. It's hard to tell. But anyway, they want the Cobra tag. Why do they want it? Because this thing kicks behind. It's fantastic. What does it do? It keeps you from losing your keys and also losing your smartphone. How does it work? It's simple. You put it on your keychain. It's got a little button on it. Okay? So let's say you lose your smartphone. Now, you've downloaded the free Cobra Tag app on your smartphone, right? That's what you've done. So you lose your smartphone. Where's your smartphone? You hit the little button on the Cobra Tag that's on your keychain, and it beeps and it lets you find your smartphone. And it works in reverse. You can't find your keys. They're lost on the couch. Maybe they're lost on the street outside the car that you dropped. You didn't realize it. You launch the smartphone app, and boom, it beeps and lets you find your keys. And it works over Bluetooth. So it just works very, very simply. It works on your Android device. Works on any of your smartphones. It's super simple. And plus, they make the Cobra iRadar. We've told you about the Cobra iRadar here on the show before. And it is the sleek, compact detection device, the radar detection device that works in your car, pairs over Bluetooth with your smartphone, and the database is updated twice daily. So speed traps, red light cameras, all the different types of radar devices that cops are using out there, you're protected. And it makes you a safer driver, more alert driver on the road because you're using the Cobra iRadar device. And to actually see all the alerts pop up on your smartphone screen, it's brilliant. It works so well, and we highly recommend them. Go to CobraElectronics.com. Check out everything they have to offer. You can order everything on Amazon, too. They've got the Cobra tag and the Cobra iRadar over there as well. We thank them so much for their support of this show. Go check them out at CobraElectronics.com. Now, my friend, I guess it's that time.
All right, then. Well, a member of the Egghead Army, Brian, wrote to us with a number of submissions for Guilty Pleasure song ideas, and I thought we would pluck one from his list. Now, a couple of the suggestions here have been played before. Set Adrift on Memory Bliss by PM Dawn is a song I've played before here on The Grizz. And correct me if I'm wrong here, Clayton, but one of his other ones, Only in My Dreams by Debbie Gibson, has also come up, right? We have played a Debbie Gibson song, haven't we?
Only in My Dreams. Name another Gibson song off the top of your
head. Shake Your Love. There's also Electric Youth.
Electric Youth, I think, was played on here. And definitely Shake Your Love was played, but that wasn't a Guilty Pleasure. We just played that like a few years ago for the heck of it.
So, sorry, those you'll have to go back and dig them up, Brian. However, one of them here, I will agree, is a Guilty Pleasure song. And I think, certainly, this is not one that either Clayton or I would ever think of to typically play, but it definitely belongs there. From the early 80s Flash Gordon soundtrack, Flash's theme by Queen, which I have to admit, when I'm singing that, it's Windows Up time. What say you, Mr. Morris?
Yeah, it'll come on rotation once in a while, like when I've got, you know, the iTunes on shuffle mode, and that'll come up, and my wife will look at me, and I'll just stop what I'm doing and just sing, Flash. Ah, you can't not sing it, right?
Right.
But if you sing it publicly, it's embarrassing.
I agree. And so this seems like a fine pick. So well done, Brian. We will spin that for you right now as one of our final Guilty Pleasure songs. Here's Flash's theme by Queen.